This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 2nd of June 2014 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show, as questions mount for both FIFA and Qatar about the 2022 World Cup bidding process, we'll assess whether the Gulf state may lose the right to host the tournament. I'll be joined by Alessio Patilano and Ivor Gaber to discuss that and the rest of the day's news. Also ahead...
Buenos días a todos.
His Majesty King Juan Carlos has just announced to me his intention to renounce the throne and to open the process of succession.
Spain's Prime Minister announces the abdication of King Juan Carlos after almost 40 years on the throne. We'll ask why three of Europe's reigning monarchs have relinquished their thrones in the space of a year. And a little later in the programme, we'll speak to the author who traced the course of the 1914 Giro d'Italia. All that, plus we'll speak to one of our correspondents around the world and bring you some music too. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So lots coming up in the next hour here on Midori House, but before any of that, here's James Luckhurst with the latest news.
Monocle 24 News. Far-reaching new federal regulations just unveiled in Washington reveal that the US power sector must cut carbon dioxide emissions by 30% by the year 2030. The new rules from the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, form the centerpiece of the Obama administration's climate change strategy. Correspondents say they could transform the power sector, which relies on coal for nearly 38% of electricity. Gina McCarthy is the administrator of the EPA.
For the sake of our families' health, and for our kids' future, we have a moral obligation to act on climate. When we do, we'll turn risks of climate into business opportunity. We'll spur innovation and investment, and we'll build a world-leading clean energy economy. The science is clear, the risks are clear, and the high costs of climate inaction keep piling up.
King Juan Carlos has announced he's to abdicate in favour of his son after almost 40 years on the Spanish throne. He's ruled since 1975, taking the throne just 2 days after the death of the Spanish dictator General Franco. For much of his reign, Juan Carlos was seen as a hugely popular monarch, but analysts say many Spaniards have lost confidence in him in recent years. Security forces remain on the streets in Turkey after fresh clashes in Ankara. Violence continued the day after the first anniversary of mass anti-government rallies in the country. The UN nuclear chief, Yukiya Amano, has rare praise for Iran today, saying it had begun to engage substantively with a long-delayed probe into suspected atom bomb research. Mr. Amano said Iran's cooperation with the IAEA had helped the organization gain a better understanding of the program, but he stressed it would take time before IAEA could deliver any verdict on whether Iran's nuclear program has possible military dimensions, or PMD.
I myself would like to see speeding up of the process. These things, clarifying on the issues related to PMD, as well as others, require time, while rushing to cover everything at one time is not the right approach. We have agreed to take a step-by-step approach, and we are trying to the maximum to clarify the issues.
The British Prime Minister David Cameron has suggested the World Cup 2022 bidding process could be reopened if corruption allegations surrounding Qatar's winning campaign are proved accurate. A British newspaper on Sunday claimed it had evidence that around $5 million was paid to officials in return for votes for Qatar's successful bid, allegations organisers have vehemently denied. FIFA's Ethics Committee has already launched an investigation into the 2022 bidding process, headed by US lawyer Michael Garcia, who's expected to report to President Sepp Blatter and his officials soon after the end of the 2014 World Cup in Brazil. Mr. Cameron had this to say about the inquiry.
I think we should let that inquiry take place rather than prejudge it. My memories of that bidding process are, as I've said earlier, not happy memories in terms of the way the whole thing was arranged and the role of FIFA and the rest of it. Let's let the inquiry take place.
Malawi's President Peter Mutharika says economic stability and national unity will be the focus of his government as he becomes the fifth leader of the Southern African state following a disputed election. Professor Mutharika was declared the winner of the May the 20th election last week and said his administration would target annual economic growth of 7% and promised a lean cabinet of 20, including deputy ministers, which was half the size of previous governments. And Thailand's military rulers have announced emergency economic measures, including restrictions on fuel prices and loans for small firms. It's an attempt to boost the Thai economy, struggling after months of political turmoil, which led to last month's military coup. That's the latest news here at Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, and we're right back after this.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, de London. This is Monocle 24.
London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. And the time now is 18.06 here in London, which means it's 13.06 in New York. And joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio is Dr. Alessio Patilano from King's College London's Department of War Studies and Ivor Gaber, Professor of Political Journalism from City University. Welcome both to the programme. Well, let's begin with a look at Qatar. There are two very different stories surrounding the nation today. The weekend saw revelations about how exactly Qatar allegedly won the bid to host the 2022 World Cup. It's claimed that the tiny state came out on top after former vice president of FIFA and Qatari national Mohammed bin Hamman paid bribes and made illegal gifts. Meanwhile, Qatar has played its part in the go-between as the go-between in the US Taliban talks that led to the prisoner exchange of five Guantanamo detainees for US Army Sergeant Bowie Bergdahl. Welcome all to the show. Let's start with you, Alessandro. What do you make of the revelations about the World Cup? You know, obviously for footballing nations and for what it meant for football, it's kind of important. But what do you think it means for Qatar?
Well, I think that it continues on this very bad streak, this negative sort of wave, because we've heard for months now, it all started with the problems concerning the potential weather conditions that would be difficult. And now, so that already had created a little bit of a storm in a teacup, but nonetheless, one that had been quite resilient in the news. And now what we're looking at is a situation that would be, if proved sort of real, it would be absolutely staggering, terrible news for the Qatari authorities. Because what we're talking about is a massive potential scandal of bribery that, of course, would cast even more of a terrible light on the event. In fact, I was reading the news earlier on this afternoon. You know, other countries that were quite upset by the situation, like Australia, Japan, they've been sort of one way or another saying that they would be happy to support a reopening up of the bidding. So in terms of soft power, this event that was supposed to be a catalyst for this part of the world, for Qatar and, you know, Middle East in terms of being represented and hosting such an important event, at the moment, we're looking at a rather sort of a gloomy picture.
Ivor, how do you read it? Because it is interesting what, you know, Alessia is saying there, because, you know, it was meant to be a soft power victory. And now we have these two kind of strange images from the weekend. You know, one, you know, Qatar are still kind of promoting itself as the honest broker, the person you can rely on, who's, you know, who will tell the truth and who's, you know, kind of squeaky clean. But on the other hand, it looks to be kind of just like some dodgy third world nation.
Well, I'd love to talk about the World Cup because I'm a great football fan, but I think you do raise a much bigger issue. This is one corner of, as you said, a huge soft power offensive that's been going on a long time, and in bits and pieces is just slightly unravelling. I'll just point, obviously we have the issue of the World Cup, which frankly was literally unbelievable until it happened. But Al Jazeera, which is Qatar's shop window on the world, or of the world, is having problems, obviously, in Egypt, as we all know. But because I'm told by Egyptian colleagues that although the Al Jazeera that I see, because I'm not an Arabic speaker, Al Jazeera English, presents a pretty decent view of the world, Al Jazeera Arabic has very much identified itself with the Muslim Brotherhood. And that's becoming unstuck. There were controversies about their coverage of the Arab Spring, being very sympathetic to Bahrain, which is close to them. And I think this massive soft power initiative that the Qataris launched about 15 years ago, which has covered not just these big events, but a whole string of educational events, arts initiatives, it's just beginning to untangle a bit. And I think it'll be very interesting to see if the World Cup does go pear-shaped for them, if they are shown to have got it by bribery. I just wonder if they'll then retreat into their haunches and give up the soft power offensive for the interim.
Alessio, you know, when you look at the talks with the Taliban, you know, they've allowed the Taliban to set up an office in Qatar. That's angered the Afghans, it's angered many other people, but it's kind of been useful for the Americans. When you look at on their other plays for soft power, their other kind of role in the world of diplomacy, do you think they've been a little bit more successful there?
Well, definitely they had an important role, but they were part of a bigger package, if you want. They had an advantageous position and obviously their ability to interact and in a way the links and the allowance they made to Taliban figures, of course, that allowed a lot more to come across, and certainly to have Qatar as this sort of platform where you knew interaction were happening. But again, here what we're looking at is a picture that is becoming ever so more complicated, and there is very mixed signals coming out of Qatar. I think the problem is even in the case of the Taliban, and as you know, images of scandals and other sort of more conservative positions in the Arabic world are become known, this raises question to the extent to which the Qatari authorities actually do have that sort of consolidated, established credibility. And I think this is something that one has to be very careful. I suppose that, you know, it's all ironic, if you think about it, because the football has absolutely nothing to do with diplomacy, soft power, and in if you want,
well,
world studying.
Well, except football, such a big issue around the world.
But exactly. But then all of a sudden becomes one of these elements where the balance it is going to start change. Because if on such an important event, if it were true of all the allegations about the bribery, so vast and sort of outreaching, that would suggest that there is something intrinsically not particularly pleasant about the place altogether. And therefore question in a broader sense all the various political commitment on the international arena.
Ivor, what do you think should be done? Should we have another go at deciding who gets it? Because let's be honest, FIFA isn't, as an institution, isn't, you know, very quick to move on these situations.
Well, I mean, I have to say, I think FIFA and possibly the International Olympic Committee are pretty rotten organisations to the core. I think there's a very, very strong case for rerunning it, not just because actually of these bribery allegations recently, but because of the whole bribery cloud that has hung over FIFA. Half the executive who voted for Qatar to get the World Cup, and Russia for that matter, in 2018, are no longer there. So you've got half the executive is entirely new. And we've got time, given the clouds that are hanging over this. I think there should definitely be a re-vote. I'm surprised that those nations that competed with Qatar, the United States, Australia, Japan, aren't making more of the noise. It's only the English FA under Greg Dyke that have actually so far publicly said there should be a re-vote. I'm just surprised, and it just shows the power of the old boy network, that at the moment people are sitting on their hands. But I think events, the momentum, and if the Sunday Times, which is promising more and more revelations, can back up the initial story, I think a re-vote will have to take place. I also think there are questions about the Russian decision in 2018. The two were linked very closely. Now, obviously, 2018, rearranging that might be problematic, but that's 4 years away. I can think of a European country that's got very good stadiums that successfully ran the Olympics recently that might be an occasion. But certainly, yeah, it should be rerun, without a doubt.
It's interesting, Alessio, FIFA, you know, they seem to kind of, you know, be self-policing in many senses, but I understand that because these bribes were allegedly paid in US dollars, it does actually allow the American authorities to kind of like weigh in. And it is amazing that actually no, there's been no proper criminal investigation launched, even after all the bribery allegations we've heard over the last few years, don't you think?
No, absolutely. I think I think Ivor was absolutely right when he pointed out that it looks very much, the more we hear about it, the more you get a feeling that it's rotten at the very heart. It's like a small little clab that holds control and the sort of tight grip and things. And I think that isn't right in a way. And you know, I think it is very important to set the record straight, and eventually if one has to rerun it to show that, so be it. But I think, you know, the highest price that you're going to pay, no matter what, is actually sort of risking of missing the real point. This is about an institution that is corrupt, whereas if you rerun the thing now, you have the risk to sort of create a divide. You don't want to do it to Qatar because it's not from Europe, you know, they're not part of that element, which I think, you know, sport is the big unifying factor, and it's really the real victim, if you want, in this particular context, because this is all about people that were corrupted. It has very little to do with the spirit of sports, and certainly what it should mean for the international community as the unifying bond that takes us together.
Well, let's move on now. The case of a Christian woman in Sudan sentenced to death for allegedly giving up the Muslim faith has been at the centre of an international outcry over the past few days, as the British Prime Minister David Cameron and other international leaders called on the Sudanese authorities to let her go. Well, in a swift and surprising move on Sunday, a spokesman from Sudan's foreign ministry suggested that Meriam Ibrahim, who gave birth to a baby girl while in her prison cell, would be released within days. Ivor, it's been a kind of a terrible story to watch this played out. And I guess one of the key things that people have been saying is, you know, what is the role of foreign governments here? What can we do and what should we do? What's your take on that?
Well, I think it's horrendous, but I fear that this one has only come to our attention because she is married to an American, a man who has American citizenship and was able to contact and make the case known to the international media. I fear this is not uncommon in Sudan. I think we should remind ourselves that the president of Sudan is currently indicted by the International Criminal Court for his the alleged role in Darfur. This is not a whiter than white regime by any stretch of the imagination. It, clearly, one can't express sufficient horror of what's going on. However, I come back to the point that she's married to an American citizen, and I find the silence of the United States government on this surprising. I mean, David Cameron and most European leaders have immediately condemned the Sudanese government. And President Obama has remained uncharacteristically silent on this issue, given that there's an American citizen, her husband's American, involved. I don't understand that. I mean, one can speculate all sorts of reasons. But international outcries do make a difference. I suspect the Sudanese Foreign Office official, unfortunately, was speaking out of turn. Well, we know he has been contradicted by other higher Sudanese authorities who said the courts will make the final decision. But I'm completely convinced that with sufficient international outrage, and I think countries have a right, not necessarily to militarily intervene in other countries, but they've certainly got a right to say what they think about their conduct on matters of international human rights, on breaches of the United Nations Charter of Human Rights. Having said that, of course, the irony, if that's the right word, or the sick aspect of this, is that the Sudanese constitution also includes a clause protecting religious practice. They say, of course, she's not a proper Christian because her father was Muslim. Freedom of conscience is not something that is recognised in that country. And I think the more that civil society, international governments protest and speak that outrage, the better.
Alessio, we hear a lot about what's happening to Christians, you know, across the continent. You know, we've been covering a great deal what's been happening to the Christian community in the north of Nigeria. We've covered also what happens to the Christian community in Syria. Do you think that, you know, this is part of a series of stories which are beginning to build up? Actually, there's kind of a bit of pushback after many years of just covering like what happens to the Muslim faith and recognizing that many people have been persecuted and had a difficult time, that there's now a lot of stories coming to the fore about what's happening to the Christian community as well.
I think certainly there is an element of tension that exists. I mean, you know, this is a little bit of the theme of the past decade or so, because we're so accustomed now to understand, I suppose, this is a post 9/11 type of theme, of topic, of mainstream topic nowadays. You know, how different communities reconcile with each other, how they live together. I think this is very much at the very heart of the way the narrative of the terrorist attacks on 9/11 has been constructed. So I think over the years we started exploring this theme in a much broader sense. So we focused first and foremost about how this was happening in our communities. You know, remember even, you know, Prime Minister Cameron manifesto when he was running the campaign, it was about the bigger society. It was about how construct a better sort of environment for all different religious and ethnic groups to live together. So I think we're just growing accustomed to this being part of the big themes. And of course, we're going back after a number of years of listening how others were trying to sort of adjust to a European environment. Now we started sort of go out there and trying to see how other Christian communities are fitting into the reality. And the truth of the story, you know, the truth of the story is that this is happening, but with lots of strings attached to it, so with lots of pain, with lots of suffering, because as it happens, it isn't difficult sort of to get together. And if you add on top of that, that I think one of the problems with this story in particular in Sudan is that, you know, Sudanese authorities are not respecting the charter, the African Human Rights Charter that they signed. So, you know, this is absolutely preposterous in so many ways. And that's why public outcry internationally should be sort of very strong on the subject.
Well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck, Alessio Patilano and Ivor Gaber. When we return, we'll assess the 25th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square protests and ask why abdication is the word of the moment for many of Europe's monarchies. Stay with us.
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more. But I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take 5 times as long as actually designing the letter forms, which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's normal anxiety.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24.
Well, welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me is Alessio Patilano of King's College London and Ivor Gaber of City University here in London. Now, we're going to look at Tiananmen Square. This is what was happening 25 years ago today.
The government has to admit that this demonstration is a patriotic demonstration.
Well, that was a very short amount of what was happening this time 25 years ago. Alessio, we'll come to you because I know this is something you know a great deal about. It's kind of incredible when you think that there were, you know, over 1 million people crammed into Tiananmen Square. The real kind of hunger for change, the belief that, you know, the Communist Party had, you know, had its sell-by date come round. And here we are. They're still very much in power, as tough as ever, and nothing really has changed, or has it?
You know, I was pondering this very question this morning, and one thought always comes back to my mind, and this is something that probably is one of the striking facts when for the visitor there that goes to Tiananmen Square for the first time these days, and that is to see the incredible, unbelievable amount of CCTVs across the square. I mean, something like that that hasn't happened in 1989 today, it wouldn't possibly be happening because everybody would be able to monitor every single centimetre of the square at any given point in time. So you've got that element. So that partly answers the question. And I think it's a very vivid image in the sense of this is a party, this is a ruling, this is a government that remains in power because of its ability to control and over the past 20 years, in many ways, redirected the attention of Chinese people towards areas and in ways they thought would be appropriate. That being said, the Chinese society and Chinese people today do live in a much sort of better conditions. The economy is, after all, doing very well. And the government has been promising over time and delivering over time a degree of reforms socially and to an extent politically. Are we looking at a fully-fledged democracy? Certainly not. Are we looking at a meritocracy in the way we've seen in other places in the West? Not necessarily, because of all the stories that we hear. But I think that when you are you have to give some credit to the CCP, because when you are sort of trying to govern more than a billion individuals, it isn't the easiest thing ever. And in that respect, so far, they've done a decent job. That being said, as I said at the beginning, the image of the CCTVs speaks volumes of the way they still are capable of doing that. That is an element of control and repression that still exists in the society.
And I guess, just stay with you quickly, Alessio, for a short point on this, but I guess the real issue is also now it's not just a class or a kind of a city thing. It's now become a regional thing. They're now fighting the Uyghurs. They're now fighting Muslim separatists. There's still fissures running through China that are forcing them to be tough and to, we've seen another attack in Tiananmen Square. We saw a bomb set off by a Uyghur separatist. So it's not as though all that control, actually brings about a kind of peaceful, calm situation. They have situations and problems they still need to deal with.
Absolutely. I mean, this is absolutely true, but I think this is one of the big tensions and contradictions of China. When you interact with Chinese officials, academics outside of China, they will go to a great way to make a point that to present China as a unicum, China as a sort of unifying, universal concept. But the beauty of China is its diversity. And I think what really, until this moment, has been one of the biggest problems for the CCP is how to reconcile their ability to sort of shepherd the Chinese people with the fact that if you allow and allowing that diversity to come across, if people outside China knew more about that, nobody would actually question the country. And I think over time, you'd be able to reconcile these differences, which at the moment find their only way to express themselves through these acts, especially with the areas like in Central Asia, where the minorities are so crushed and sort of held
down. Ivor, you wanted to jump in.
Yeah, well, I'm certainly not wishing to contradict anything Alessio said, but I had a different take on it, that I spent some time, one does from the outside tend to get a monolithic impression of China, and it's, you mentioned diversity. I was working with Chinese investigative journalists, training them on investigative techniques, and what interested me was actually why did the Chinese government want me to do this, because they had to give their permission, and they wanted to use investigative journalists to investigate corruption up to a certain level. And it was unspoken, but they certainly spoke it to me, the Chinese journalists. They knew where what they called the red lines were. So they did have freedom to report local businessmen, local party officials, local bureaucrats being corrupt. But as soon as their research took them above a certain level, they knew, I go no further. So you've got this obvious, this interesting. I was very surprised when I was in China a few years ago seeing demonstrations. But of course, these were demonstrations at a local level.
Yeah.
Certainly not at Tiananmen Square.
Well, I want to stop you there, gentlemen, because we need to get one more story in before the bottom of the hour. Earlier today, the Spanish Prime Minister announced that King Juan Carlos is to abdicate the throne. This is the part of the announcement.
Buenos días a todos.
His Majesty King Juan Carlos has just announced to me his intention to renounce the throne and to open the process of succession.
Good thing, bad thing, Ivor?
I love that notion of opening the process of succession. Was he suggesting a vote? I mean, I think that's a great idea. But clearly, that you mentioned in the intro that there was a fashion for abdication. We've had the Belgian, the Dutch, and now the Spanish heads of state stepping to abdicating in favour of a younger relative. I wonder how this is going down in Buckingham Palace. She's doing a great job, but she's into her 80s. I just feel sorry for Prince Charles, without supporting or opposing any of his interesting political views. Mm-hmm. It's really a bit embarrassing now, isn't it? It's time for him to have a job.
Alessio, sticking with the Spanish royal family, it's almost like modern politics. The king had an approval rating around like 30-40%. The new king-to-be, Crown Prince Felipe, has approval ratings 60% plus. It's almost like the family is sitting down thinking, okay, this is, you need to go because otherwise this business is going to go really badly wrong.
I think it is important to give a strong image of a clean slate. You need a new face. You need to, if you want really to, I think Spain, like the rest of the other European countries that went through a very difficult economic time, like Italy, they have to provide themselves with a clear sense of a new start, and you need a new face for that. And symbolically in Spain, that is you know, the abdication of the king, because the king, even though he was very popular at the very low point in time where the economy was doing bad because of course of his hunting expedition,
they're not wise to shoot an elephant. Yes, in
no, the absolutely. Of so I think in that respect, what you have there is the potential to line up with a new face. Prince Felipe, he's married to a former television presenter. They do have the characteristics of a country that wants to focus no longer on the austerity, but on a new sort of renewal.
If a PR chief had been told to kind of choose a new king and queen, this is who he'd choose. You know, exactly. Kind of
certainly not the daughter.
No,
no, certainly not.
That's another story. Well, we're going to have to leave it there, gentlemen. Alessio Patilano of the Department of War Studies at King's College London and Ivor Gaber, Professor of Journalism at City University here in London. Thank you very much for joining us on Midori House.
Thank you.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24. This is Monocle 24. London, New York, Tokyo. Tokyo. London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
Well, plenty still to come then in the second half of today's Midori House. Our correspondent in Bamako, Alex Duval-Smith, will run us through the local news from Mali. Author Tim Moore will recount his experience of riding the Giro d'Italia, 1914 style. And we'll end the show with a review of the week's art openings. But before we get started on that, here's James Luckhurst with the world news headlines.
Far-reaching new federal regulations just unveiled in Washington reveal that the US power sector must cut carbon dioxide emissions by 30% by the year 2030. The new rules from the Environmental Protection Agency form the centerpiece of the Obama administration's climate change strategy. King Juan Carlos has announced he's to abdicate in favor of his son after almost 40 years on the throne of Spain. He's ruled since 1975, taking the throne just 2 days after the death of the Spanish dictator General Franco. Security forces remain on the streets in Turkey after fresh clashes in Ankara. Violence continued the day after the first anniversary of mass anti-government rallies in the country. The UN nuclear chief Yukiya Amano has rare praise for Iran today, saying it had begun to engage substantively with a long-delayed probe into suspected atom bomb research. British Prime Minister David Cameron has suggested the World Cup 2022 bidding process could be reopened if corruption allegations surrounding Qatar's winning campaign are proved accurate. A British newspaper on Sunday claimed it had evidence that around $5 million was paid to officials in return for votes for Qatar's successful bid. Those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, James. And James will be back in another 30 minutes with the full roundup of the world news. But welcome back to Midori House, live here on Monocle 24. The time now is 18:32 here in London, which means it's 21:32 in Moscow and 14:32 in Rio de Janeiro. And it's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. And today we head to Mali, where our correspondent, Alex Duval-Smith, joins us on the line from Bamako. Alex, welcome to the programme. Now, let's start, first of all,
thanks,
with something that happened 10 days ago, which is a military attack on a town of Kidal. Can you explain the significance of this to us?
Yes, well, about on the 21st of May, the Malian army launched an attack on Kidal. Kidal, ever since the crisis which began in Mali in 2012, Kidal has been in the hands, essentially most of the time, of the secessionist rebels of the MNLA and other armed rebel groups. And despite the fact that this country managed to have an election last year and to move to a certain degree of normality, Kidal has remained under secessionist control. control. So 10 days ago, the government decided to put an end to this, launching a futile and quite deadly attack on the town. At least 50 Malian soldiers died. Fighting went on for only about 4.5 hours, and in that time they were forced to retreat. A very, very similar situation as to that which happened all over Mali in 2012 and 13. And of course we know what happened next, which was the occupation of the country by Islamists linked to Al-Qaeda, and then the French and international intervention in Mali. So there's been a lot of fear, and things aren't entirely sorted out, because armed rebels have taken control of a number of towns, and there aren't that many towns in the northern two-thirds of Mali. Essentially, much of the area is currently under rebel control again.
Well, if the rebels are having a bit of a free hand, or certainly holding on to the territory they have in the north, what can be done about it? So, you know, France has begun to pull down its troops. Are they likely to ride to the rescue? Or do you think there has to be some kind of negotiation?
Well, France was in the process of a drawdown and of reconfiguring its Sahel coverage to be one of what they called counter-terror, moving from the height of the French presence in Mali last year, which was 5,000 troops, down to about 1,000 and 3,000 spread across the region. Now, that's had to be reversed, and in fact some reinforcements have been brought in. France has about 1,600 soldiers here at the moment that they admit to anyway. And of course the UN is here with MINUSMA, a force that's supposed to be 12,000 strong but is struggling to reach those figures, and also lacks the military hardware really to make it effective on the ground, though of course drone surveillance is much better than it was. Essentially what's happened has been a warning signal, I think, to the international community, which had perhaps begun to think that things had taken a turn for the better in Mali, but also, as you're implying, to the Malian government, which has been resisting negotiating. And we have had some signs in the last few days that negotiations could be getting off to a gentle start.
But do you think there can be a negotiation here? You know, when you have extremists who believe in the toughest form of Sharia law, when you have people who are opposed to music in a country that's famous for music, can there be the kind of negotiations that we would think of as being needed to bring around a resolution?
Well, the international community's view would be that Mali doesn't need to negotiate with any of the extreme Islamist groups linked to Al-Qaeda, but it does need to negotiate with the secessionists who want independence for the northern two-thirds of the country. And that's where it gets very complicated, because groups like the MNLA, the National Movement for the Liberation of Azawad, do have links and have had with a number of essentially what you can call desert mercenaries, some of whom occasionally cross over into fighting for groups like Al-Qaeda. So it's very, very difficult to see the difference between the secessionists who have a political, if you like, argument for to some extent, though I mean a lot of Malians would say that they're a tiny, tiny minority, to the Islamists, and then to also really what has dominated this region because of poor governance over decades. Criminals, smugglers, people bringing fuel in from Algeria, where it's subsidized and therefore cheaper, to places like Timbuktu, which are very cut off because poor governance has led to a lack of development, lack of roads. A place like Timbuktu is more closely connected to the desert than it is to the capital of the country, Bamako, which has made it a sort of a playing field for smugglers of all kinds. So, in amongst all of this, there are people to negotiate with, but who?
Alex, tell me, we talked about musicians earlier, and I understand that there is finally some move, because this community has been a little bit quieter than one might have imagined in a country famous for its music, but there is an attempt to kind of bring around some reconciliation, perhaps with some music as well.
Yes, well, Salif Keita, who's one of the best-known musicians from here, has actually announced a reconciliation tour that'll be taking place in August with a tour bus going around the country and sort of delivering a reconciliation message, much needed. And I think you know, some of the people who care about Malian music have been quite disappointed in the way in which the established Malian musicians haven't done more to actually give something back to their country at this time. And to use music as such a powerful tool to bring about reconciliation. Well, Salif Keita does seem to be at long last wanting to shift that trend and maybe followed by others. And one, you know, I mean, the only problem with Salif Keita and those Malian musicians we know about is that they're not always the most popular Malian musicians in Mali. But anyway, it's a move for the better.
Well, Alex, thank you very much for joining us. That was our correspondent, Alex Duval-Smith, in Bamako there. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Up next, I'm going to sit down with the author Tim Moore to talk about his new book, Geronimo. Do stay with us.
On this week's edition of The Foreign Desk, we head to Africa to ask why being gay is still one of the most divisive issues on the continent today.
I never knew what they were doing. That's how I've been told recently that what they do is terrible, disgusting.
There's been sustained campaigns on the part of the media. Almost immediately, the people named in those stories, they face threats of violence, and it does give a kind of push to this politicized homophobia.
From Uganda to Senegal, South Africa to Kenya, we hear from those who have been persecuted.
In the opinion pages, it's they have to be killed, stoned, burned. They have to be chased out of Senegal, and they're not the real Senegalese.
And from those hoping to change perceptions and the law for gay, lesbian, bisexual and transgender people across Africa.
The Constitution is only a legal document. It is cold, it is written on paper, and we have to deal with the minds and hearts of people.
I'm actually getting goosebumps as I talk about this, but there is a movement, and that is my hope, that in another 5 years, this will be an even more colourful continent.
That's Out and African, this week's edition of The Foreign Desk, with me, Steve Bloomfield, here on Monocle 24.
Well, welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. Now, for those with an eye on the sport of cycling, one of the world's toughest challenges came to an end yesterday, the Giro d'Italia, won by a Colombian, Nairo Quintana, his first Grand Tour victory. Well, despite the challenges faced by Quintana, there is one particular example of that race that stands out in time for being especially tough, the 1914 Giro. Our next guest has attempted to reenact that historic race, not in spandex and the latest in protective sportswear. Instead, amateur cyclist and author Tim Moore set off with leather goggles, a woolen cycling shirt, and a mainly wooden bike. With the diary of the 1914 winner as his companion, Tim tells the story of his experience on the Giro d'Italia in his new book, Geronimo, and he joins us on the line now. Tim, thank you very much for joining us. What on earth were you thinking when you started to do this?
That's a very good question. I think it was because, 12 years ago I cycled the route of the Tour de France, the slightly more well-known cycling race, and it seemed like an impressive achievement at the time. Obviously, subsequently, I kind of felt that it had been sort of eroded slightly and by the revelations about Lance Armstrong and co. And I kind of felt the need to kind of, you know, reclaim what it was that I rediscover what I originally attracted me to the sport. And somehow this ended up with me going back into the past and in the search of a nobler age of untarnished heroes. And I wound up discovering this about this appalling 1914 race, and I guess it was perhaps some sort of midlife crisis, to be honest, because I'm pushing 50, and it just seemed like what better way to do that than to set myself this absolutely appalling physical task and try and achieve it in the most authentic manner imaginable.
Well, at least you've got the knees for it still. Now, just tell us, what made that 1914 race particularly bad?
Well, essentially, in those days, there was a kind of fascination with pushing humans to the limit of their endurance. And so this race, which obviously was, you know, they had to use 1914 equipment, so incredibly heavy bicycles, no gears, that sort of thing. And then they were required to ride 400-kilometre stages non-stop through the night. So they started out at Milan, And, you know, so off they set up 400-kilometre stage. And, of course, because the Giro, which has just finished now, tends to take place at a time of year when, if you do go up into the mountains, of which there are plenty, as I discovered to my painful cost in Italy, they will often be covered in snow. So the first stage took place in pretty much a rolling blizzard, sub-zero temperatures, howling kind of winds, awful sabotage as well. Some of the locals in Italy, it was a very poor country then, so the locals had a great suspicion of this newfangled bicycles coming through, and the farmers would get out because they think their crops are going to be damaged, their cattle will be scared into not producing milk, so they scattered, you know, thousands of nails all over the road, so everyone had multiple punctures. Anyway, the net effect of all this was that by the end of that first stage, half the field of 81 riders had been wiped out at a stroke. And pretty similar stories took place in every other stage. There were 8 stages in all. I mean, as I say, 20 hours of non-stop cycling on these gravel roads. So in the end, only 8 people managed to get back to Milan 3,200 kilometres later, which was the most appalling rate of attrition in the history of the sport.
So cut to today, and you're there on your mostly wooden bicycle, and you've got your goggles on. What did the Italians make of you as you went around their country?
Well, it's interesting, really, because they do have a great affection for their kind of, they call it the Il Ciclismo Eroica, the kind of the golden heroic age of cycling. So lots of old men would, you know, leap up outside cafes and hail me with, you know, cries of their favourite riders from their youth, even though obviously their youth wasn't quite as distant as 1914. So they'd be, oh, Fausto Coppi, and they would all run after me in a, well, you know, waddle after me. And there's a lot of enthusiasm in that way. But at the same time, other people, because they had an even greater affection for these old bicycles, they said, why you do this? This is a museum piece. You shouldn't be punishing this old lady like that. This 100-year-old bicycle, which they thought it was a terrible thing that I was doing. And of course, there was a third strand of, because these goggles, which you referred to earlier, did make me look rather alarming. So young mothers would tend to gather their children close to their skirts as I went past. Because I just did. They looked like a kind of Victorian welding kind of get-up with this ridiculous, massive, baggy cloth cap as well. It was conspicuous, I have to say.
And for the old legs, which was the worst bit of the tour?
Well, the worst bit of
your whole tour. I don't mean in the fashion stakes. I mean for the endurance of kind of up mountain, and you don't go down dale, do you, in Italy? But which was the most brutal part for you?
Well, to be honest, actually, the going up mountains without any gears was pretty scary. But because my bicycle had wooden wheels, because that was what they had in 1914, you can't use rubber brakes to slow down wood, because the wood gets very hot and the rubber melts. So the only material which you can use is cork. So I had to make my own brakes out of wine corks. Prosecco, I found, was the best raw material, so that gave me something to do in the evenings. But going down, so pushing the bike up the Alps, as I generally had to do, having found photographs of 1914 racers pushing their bikes up hills, was a precedent I was very glad to replicate.
I even read in your book that a couple of them cheated and got towed up by a car.
Yeah, they did do that. In fact, the guy who won it, who became a sort of great hero of mine, and I was going through this history of the race as I kind of went through it, building up this kind of, you know, elevating him to these great heights of Corinthian sportsmanship, and then I discovered he had just cheated massively in the most blatant manner by getting a lift up the hill in the car, even though he denied it brilliantly. He just said, oh, I saw my teammate getting a lift in the car. I was so appalled I went up to remonstrate with him, at which point the referee's car came in the corner, and I can see it may have looked as if I was clinging onto the car, but really I was...
And just tell me physically for you, when you'd kind of finished the thing, how many grazes, how many kind of like broken knees, how did you feel at the end?
Well, I kind of, cycling is quite forgiving in a way. So by the time I got to the end, I just, by default, I'd become incredibly fit. You know, I think, well, it was actually stopping, having done all this 3,000 and something kilometres, by the end, of course, your legs expected you to keep doing more of it. So it was quite hard afterwards to, I had to get up in the night and run up and down the stairs for about a week because my legs were getting twitchy and confused. I didn't fall off nearly as often as I deserved to. I only fell off about 3 times, and bearing in mind I wasn't wearing a helmet, and of course the roads were full of Italian drivers, I should really have been killed several times over.
Well, Dave, thank you. We're glad you survived. And the book is called Geronimo, Riding the Very Terrible 1914 Tour of Italy, and it's out now. And thanks, Tim, for coming on the show. And now we're going to have a little bit of music. This is Violetta with Dimmi Che Non Passa. That was Violetta with Dimmici non passa, which means tell me it's not happening. And I think that was what Tim Moore was probably thinking a few times when he was kind of trekking up those hills. Well, anyway, you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, and it's time now to review the best and sometimes the worst in the worlds of television, cinema, theatre, books. You get the idea. Well, today we're going to talk with the journalist and curator Francesca Gavin. Francesca, welcome to the show, and we are here to talk about the world of art.
Hello.
Now, we're going to start with a really sweet story about a property called 87 Hackford Road, which is in London. Can you tell us about this?
Yeah, it's a fascinating installation. The house is basically where Vincent van Gogh lived when he was basically a student here when he was around 19. And the Dutch artist Saskia Alderwelbers, who's based here, created an entire installation with Art Angel where sound essentially becomes the mode of art. So you're wandering around an empty house, which is falling apart, and you're getting a sort of theatre-based narrative with sound embedded in the ground, in the walls, in sort of invisible speakers. And it's really kind of touching and wonderful and an interesting insight not only into the concept of history, but also Van Gogh's history.
And is it mainly an audio experience? And she hasn't put up, you know, copies of his paintings or anything on the wall.
The visual side of it's kind of wonderful because you're using your ears rather than your eyes. You occasionally notice different elements that have been left behind. Maybe a photograph of the people who used to live there. Or there's a tiny little thing on one shelf, which is a little piece of cherry blossom referencing certain Van Gogh paintings. But actually, more than anything, you're getting a sense of space, like this is the room that he slept in, and what kind of narrative was there between him and the daughter and the person he was staying with, and also the people who came afterwards and made it a listed building. And it's actually kind of a fascinating take on how art has to be something that's not visual at all, and how you're using other aspects of your body, thought,
and
to experience
I understand that it's kind of amazing, you know. One, most people don't realise that Van Gogh came here at all. Two, that this building has somehow survived, even though it's a bit of a wreck now. And it's been owned by other people in the past who weren't that keen on kind of allowing anyone in to see where he'd stayed or anything. So it's a kind of special moment as well that it's suddenly available, even if it is a kind of bit of a decrepit building now.
I mean, Art Angel, an amazing production company, essentially, who work with different artists on allowing us access into spaces you wouldn't normally get to see. So this is a perfect example of the kind of work that they have done in the past. They've worked with people like Douglas Gordon, for example, or Roni Horn, big artists in strange spaces internationally. So yeah, this is a wonderful experience into a space that you wouldn't get to go in otherwise. And also it's a weird little back street in Stockwell, a part of London you wouldn't necessarily go to otherwise. And it's been bought by a Chinese violinist who just wants to save it and maybe make it into a Van Gogh museum or something devoted to him in future. But at the moment, it's got this kind of weird old lino and this crazy sense of the past. It's amazing.
And when you went there, were many people rushing around, or did you have a kind of sense of, you know, because I imagine it's the kind of thing you don't need too many people there
if you want to get the best out of it. You book in and everywhere, it's a half hour experience. Okay, cool. It's very much like theatre. So there's only around 10 people per time when you're in there. So you will always have a kind of personal experience of when you're in there.
Well, let's go in the other direction. Let's go to the new museum, the third floor galleries. Now, this show, I can hardly pronounce the title, but it is an Assyrian lament. Explain this. This is complex.
Well, it's quite an interesting comparison to the Saskia Alderwelbers at Hackford Road. This is by an artist called Roberto Coaghi. He's Italian. He has a really varied practice. But this piece, which is called Shuilaku Chorale, is based on 2 years of research about 7th century BC Assyria. And he learnt this. He did a lot of research about the language and the musical instruments and created a sound piece where you go into and it's completely dark. You don't see anything, and I never like to read a press release before I go to an exhibition. I find that really annoying. And the joy of this experience is when you're in it, and it's very short, I'd say about 5 minutes long, you're just completely enveloped in sound in a way that you would never be otherwise, and it's really quite special. And then afterwards, you can discover this strange narrative history based on a city in decline under attack in 1613 BC Assyria.
But it's all musical instruments, or is it speech as well?
It's the weirdest list of instruments that you've ever heard of. Often there's vocal elements. I wouldn't exactly call it speech. Strange singing, strange verbal bits, all performed by the artist himself. But it sounds like an encyclopedia and you're traveling around the world, but it's traveling around you in darkness.
Great. Well, two kind of audio journeys there. And then finally for today, you've got something by the French filmmaker Chris Marker.
Yeah, there's a wonderful retrospective on at the Whitechapel at the moment, which I think is really interesting in the context of art being made today, referencing things like the internet and technology and memes. And Chris Marker seems so ahead of his time capturing those kind of things. There's a particularly good installation that's being shown for the first time here called The Zapping Zone, which is a proposal for television. And it's made of a variety of small different television and computer screens with different lo-fi animated elements to it and bits of French philosophers. And what makes Marker so interesting is how he kind of captured our Tumblr-esque relationship to imagery, but 20, 30, 40, 50 years before that existed. And I find that really fascinating.
So he's born in 1921 and he worked all the way through to 2012. So, you know, quite a long career. And somebody who I understand had quite an influence on lots of other artists as well.
Very, very much so. It's also in the new museum in New York. There's an artist, Camille Honoré, who won the Silver Lion for the Venice Biennale last year or 2 years ago. She has very much an encyclopedic look at culture. And I think that collaging of imagery definitely has roots in what Chris Marker does. What's also fascinating with the third gallery upstairs is examining Marker very much through a political standpoint. So looking at his involvement with documenting 1968 internationally and the political aspects of what he did, which he did a great film in 1977 that's been reworked, all about the failure of revolution, which is super fascinating.
Well, Francesca, what a great lineup. Three amazing things there to go see. That was
And no paintings.
No paintings. You can't get a postcard of any of those. That was the journalist and curator, Francesca Gavin. And that's all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Alessio Patilano of King's College London and Ivor Gaber of City University here in London. Today's show was produced by Thomas Lewis, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and James Bullock, and our studio manager was Toby Hammond. Next, after the headlines, it's The Culture Show. So plenty more art coming your way with Mr. Robert Bound. And then at 2200 hours, it's The Monocle Daily. This show will be back at the same time tomorrow at 1800 hours London time. But for this edition of Midori House, it's just time to say goodbye and thank you very much for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world-famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.